flow starting. We'll get there. Good night, everybody. Tuesday night, everyone. This is Pam Stack, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. My guest tonight needs absolutely no introduction unless you've lived on the moon or, as we were just discussing earlier, the International Space Station, but even then I think they've heard of him. Jeffrey Deaver is a former journalist, a former folk singer, probably does that still, an attorney. He's done a variety of things, but mostly he writes the most spectacular thrillers. He is internationally known and acclaimed throughout the world. And we're going to talk to him about his new book, which was just released today, called The Steel Kiss. It is a Lincoln Rhimes novel. And his short story about Lincoln Rhimes that was released on February 16, called The Delivery Man. It is my honor to welcome back to Authors on the Air for an encore interview, Mr. Jeffrey Deaver. Good evening, Jeff, and thank you so much for being my guest tonight, especially on release day.
Well, thank you, Pam. I always enjoy our conversations. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, as do I. It's an honor. Congratulations on releasing The Steel Kiss. This book is laden with technology as part of the antagonist weapon, and I found that fascinating. This is a story that very few people are talking about, the type of technology that you discuss in this book. Would it be a spoiler to talk a little bit about it with you, to ask you about the theme of the book?
Let's talk about it. Sure.
Okay.
My job as an author is to find the most, I guess I would say, harrowing circumstances that readers would find themselves in. Now, I don't really believe in ghosts and goblins, so I don't write that kind of occult book. I love Stephen King's writing, but that's just not really for me. And the terrorists, horrific people, just terrible, despicable people, but it is a bit of an abstract threat. So what I look for is a situation in which real readers can find themselves in real peril. And I'll give you an example. In the opening scene of The Bone Collector, the first in the Lincoln Rhimes series, from almost 20 years ago now, a couple gets into a taxi cab, and they sit down, and the driver turns away from where they're supposed to be going, and they panic, and they try to get out, but he's locked the doors, and that's the last we ever see of them. Well, in The Steel Kiss, I take technology, which, many people know something about, but, for instance, I know enough to scare me. I know enough to be dangerous when it comes to technology.
Right,
so,
right.
What I did was take this concept of cloud-based information. And by that, I mean so many products in our house now contain Wi-Fis. little Wi-Fi circuits, and they communicate up to the cloud, where the manufacturer of, say, your home security system or your automobile, or even now your refrigerator, stove, your furnace downstairs, communicates to the cloud for legitimate reasons. The manufacturer gets data from that, and if there's a fire, it sends information up to the security people. But that can work the other way too. And very simply, my villain in The Steel Kiss hacks into this system and sends messages back to these household items and turns them into weapons.
It's an incredible book, and it scared the crap out of me. So I have to tell you, I'm really happy. I don't have any modern appliances, and I had to run and cover up the video camera on my laptop. And I don't use GPS on my phone because, I don't think people realize, and you certainly do, because it's scary as anything, what a marvel a mobile phone is, but also how dangerous it is. And
I did a lot of research for the book, and I learned something quite interesting. We all are aware of the dangers of data theft and identity theft. Well, our computers actually are pretty sophisticated when it comes to firewalls and protections. And if one is diligent about passcodes, it's pretty hard to get into a system, unless, of course, you truly believe that there's a beautiful bride in Nigeria with $5 million and she wants to marry you and sign it over to her. You can't really save everybody from themselves. But given a certain level of caution on your computer and on your phone, you can be pretty well protected. The problem comes in, though, with these web-based devices in appliances, because they often have a very inexpensive and unsophisticated software in them. And I'll tell you a very fast story. In my research, I found this fascinating. A man was arrested for spamming, sending out millions of emails to advertise products and so forth, those irritating things. And that's a crime if you do it under certain circumstances. He didn't do it using other people's computers. He did it using other people's refrigerators. Refrigerators connected online to send diagnostic information to the refrigerator manufacturer in case they needed a new part for the machine or if a filter was going to go. The company could let you know that. Well, what happened was he had his hackers sensed the address of, I don't know how many, I'm making this up, but 10,000, 100,000 refrigerators around the country, and sent the spams through the refrigerators. I found that just fascinating.
It's amazing to me. And we all are fascinated by smart homes. So you key in, you have maybe a fingerprint that lets you in your front door, or you have a voice activation. But then you can voice activate your lights, your security system, you regulate the temperature in your home, and so on. And even your water heater, which people don't realize, I think, that at a certain level you can be scalded by that, even without smart technology. So it's fascinating to me that the systems that you're talking about, like appliances, that manufacturers do not have strong safeguards with cloud-based things like that. I think that they're probably going to get blowback when they get a load of your book. They take a peek at Steel Kiss, they're going to understand that this is really a horrible thing. And speaking of which, I was an identity theft victim in October. Thank God I don't have any money and only one credit card. It was no big deal. But it was still irritating. And as it turned out, it was a breach at the bank. There was somebody who was stealing banking customer ID. So it was a federal crime.
The bank itself. Something similar. I actually was hacked. My computer got hacked some years ago, and I called the credit card companies immediately, because if you let them know, they all have rules. You may be out $50 or something like that. Excuse me. And but I was incensed, and they charged, a big screen TV and a bunch of clothes. This was at stores in Florida. So I, being
I believe
in law enforcement, I called the Miami police or Tampa or Miami police, and I said, I'm a victim of identity theft. What are you going to do about it, sir? And they said, yeah, right. Because that falls pretty low on the level. On the scheme of things. Now, in my book, The Broken Window, I created an identity thief on steroids, you might say, and he used people's identities to kill them. So it was more than a financial gain. But I've been always trying to work in technology into my Lincoln Rhyme books. Now, my other series, Catherine Dance, set in California, she's more of a people cop. She's an investigator, but she's an interrogation expert, and she doesn't really pay much attention to forensic science and so forth. That's Lincoln's bailiwick. So I always have him run up against hackers or the identity thieves, people like that.
Yes.
But I enjoy researching it, and we do have to be cautious. The books are not treatises on protecting yourself, but you can take away a little more than just a thriller crime story.
I absolutely agree with you. I want to talk about Lincoln Rhyme because I love this character, and I love I love Sachs as well. I think they're both they're such an interesting investigative couple, but they are also personally a very interesting mm-hmm. couple. When you picture Lincoln Rhyme when you're writing him, what do you visualize when you picture him?
When I created the character many years ago, as I say, about 20 years ago now, I had in mind actors and actresses for all of my books.
Sure.
For instance, the James Bond book I wrote a few years ago, I'm aware of the actors who played James Bond.
Sure.
Oh, and this, by the way, for your listeners, is a book called Carte Blanche. I was commissioned by the Ian Fleming Estate to write that. And I had in mind not Sean Connery, not Daniel Craig, but an actor from Down Under named Guy Pearce, who is a wonderful actor, and he actually comes closest to the description by Ian Fleming of what James Bond looked like. Ian Fleming said he looked like Hoagie Carmichael, the American musician.
Yes.
And, kind of craggy looking, and I felt I'm going to keep him in mind. Well, when I was writing The Bone Collector, I had in mind two actors for Lincoln and Amelia. Lincoln, I pictured as being Harrison Ford, and Amelia was going to be Julia Roberts. But again, some years ago, that's when they were doing a bit more acting. I know Julia Roberts is doing some films now. I haven't seen Harrison Ford aside from, of course, the Star Wars recently. But I kind of kept them in their quirkiness and their their like facial structure and so forth. I kept that in mind, and I found too that when I write dialogue, I try to mimic the speech patterns of certain actors and actresses, which is of course they're reciting lines that have been written, and I don't mean so much the actual words they're saying because that's a product of the script writer, but I mean the intonation, the pauses that they make. One of my absolute favorites when I visualize someone talking was Philip Seymour Hoffman, whom of course we sadly lost a few years ago. But the way he would speak slowly and then give a very clipped phrase, I found that really helped me inhabit a character. Because as we've talked before, I sit in a dark room for most of my life and come up with these stories and visualize characters and talk to them. I guess I legitimately can talk to myself and get away with it.
There you go. Well, I think that's I have one author who said to me, I don't ever talk to my characters. They're just there. I write what they're going to say. And I thought that was so funny because most authors I know will say, I have a dialogue with them in my head. And I think that's interesting.
Sure.
They help me
figure out, and now I know that the story is going to go. I have the plot. I plan that out ahead of time. But the characters help me understand who they are.
I find that when I think now that you've put a face to Lincoln Rhyme for me, he's a man of few words. Do you think that had he not been wheelchair-bound, he would have been a different personality as far as a man of few words? I know he's a great thinker. He's exceptionally intelligent. He really is. His analysis is amazing. Would he have had more of a social personality had he not been shot in a wheelchair?
No, he was always a curmudgeon. He was kind of a pain in the butt all the time. But I will say that his skill as a forensic scientist is largely because of his disability. Now, for your listeners who may not be familiar, he was a head of the New York City Forensics Department. This is a few years before the Bone Collector opened. And what happened was injured on the job, paralyzed from the neck down. Coincidentally, this was around the time that Christopher Reeve was suffered his very serious injury. Lincoln Ryan was not quite as badly injured as he was, but it was a horrific accident that changes your life forever. And so Lincoln was forced to retire from the police department, but became a consulting detective, just like Sherlock Holmes was, actually, and maintained his forensic science, was happy to continue to do that, working with the police department. But his skill, I think, was enhanced because of his disability. He could no longer get out in the field and be distracted by things. What he had to do was focus on the evidence, which Amelia Sachs, of course, gathers, and then he focuses exclusively on the little minutiae of the trace evidence, the blood evidence, fingerprints, and so forth. And he wrestles continually with the question, well, if I could wave my magic wand and be better and cure my condition, would I therefore be able to continue being such a good forensic scientist? And he thinks maybe not. So if he were offered that opportunity, which in our lifetime may happen because there's been a lot of advancement in medical science, would he in fact go back to being, quote, normal, or let's say non-disabled? And that is a decision he may have to make in some book.
I found it fascinating that there have been times when he's been so depressed that he actually considers drinking the cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's so real and so vivid, and you can feel his pain so deeply and his frustration. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know if it's an emotional pain. I don't think there's a physical pain, but I think his frustration. And it's a brilliant, brilliant look at this man's psyche. It's just masterful.
Well, thank you. Yes, he is not actually in any physical pain. That's part of the problem. In fact, he's paralyzed from the neck down, and one of the difficult and most dangerous aspects of a disability like that is the absence of pain, because pain exists to tell us that we've picked up something that's hot. That we've been stabbed, or we have some other physical ailment. He doesn't have that that ability, but it of course, to be so disabled is a real challenge for him to frankly get up every day and continue with his life. But he's continued to make the decision that it's better to be here than not be here, and of course he leads a very productive life. And I'm continually surprised by getting an email from people who say they're reading along in the book and they have to remind themselves that Lincoln is disabled, because he inhabits a world where most of his work is pure thought. And, you know, maybe we're all that way. I think that is one reason he's become so popular, that we really are our minds before we are our physical
our bodies.
And that's why I think people relate to him. Yeah.
You have interwoven into Lincoln and Amelia's story a very sweet love story. It's a very subtle weaving in and out of the books. And there is a really dramatic ending to Steel Kiss, which I will not give away. But how did you decide to make them become personally involved? They're such different people, but I think they have a lot of respect for each other. That's one thing that is very, very noticeable. How did you decide to make them fall in love and be able to communicate that love, whether it's physically or emotionally or through kissing or, you know, touching doesn't work for Lincoln, but
right.
I sometimes wonder, does Amelia feel shortchanged by it? And I don't think she does.
No, no. And it's interesting that of the roughly 12 books in the series now, all of which involve heinous criminals, you know, mastermind villains, terrible crimes that are going to be repeated every so often, every five chapters or so, I get more feedback on their relationship than I do about the crimes itself. And people say, well, I was really sitting on the edge of my seat about Lincoln and Amelia. And how does that work? And I personally believe that love, romance, and if I may say even sex, is primarily a mental or an emotional aspect of a relationship. It isn't purely physical, and the connection that they have really transcends what would occur at a one night stand, for instance. But they certainly have an intimate life, and I've researched this. I'll add quickly, I've researched it from books and speaking with doctors. But even people who are severely disabled can have a very successful intimate life. It's a bit alternative, we would have to admit, but it certainly does happen. But mostly, I don't focus on that, really. The books are about...
You're very delicate about how you approach it, and I appreciate that because I don't want their personal story to take away from what is happening. But it is interesting because when Lincoln decides he's just not going to do police work and he's instead going to focus on the top paying jobs, you almost saw the tension between them. And I want to go back, Jeff, and I remember when you introduced Amelia as being his partner. And I remember that she was very cool about it because this is a woman who is a model. She's beautiful. She's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. She doesn't care about any of that. And they have become so intertwined with each other. It's almost like two halves of one brain. They kind of anticipate what's going to happen or what they need to make happen.
Sure, and that was my very intent. And curiously, I kind of switch what have been stereotypes, rightly or wrongly, going back in crime fiction, not so much recently, but in the past, we tended to have the man figure, the male protagonist, being the action figure, and the female, Miss Marple, for instance, would tend to be the more cerebral of the two and the more thoughtful and insightful one, solving crimes that way. Well, I kind of turn this around a bit. And so Amelia's the one who packs the Glock on her hip, who drives a muscle car around very quickly. And Lincoln is the one who stays back home and does the thinking. And so I kind of enjoyed mixing up the gender stereotypes a bit, although those don't really hold true much anymore. We still see them to some extent, but it's not like the writing from that TV show, the Mad Men days, that TV show about advertising, of course, back in the 50s and 60s. So, I will say I had a lot of fun in The Steel Kiss by taking Lincoln and Amelia, who have now 11 books worth of romance between them, and kind of throwing that into on the rocks, because in this story, Amelia has learns that her boyfriend from years ago, her lover, who she had a very intense relationship with, hasn't seen for years, is now resurfaced, and at the same time, Lincoln has a connection with a young protege, a very attractive woman.
Right.
I won't say anything more about her.
Oh, what a story
that was kind of fun.
That was a surprise. Let me tell you, that one just almost laid me out when that surprise came about. I was like, holy cow. How you could never anticipate that in a million years. But what a brilliant woman, too. What a brilliant woman.
Oh, exactly. So now Lincoln and Juliet have a connection, and Amelia and Nick have a connection. Now, I'm on record as saying I'll never kill them off. They're my main characters. I'll never kill them off. But that's not to say I can't put them through hell. I can't have them break up. I might have them go in different directions or something with new people and have more or less successful relationships with somebody else. And I won't say how that resolves in The Steel Kiss. I have to entice your listeners to go out and buy the book,
absolutely,
of course. But that is
an amazing story.
Plot. A very scary
really
plot
is.
Point in the book.
It's a very, very interesting one. And, you know, I've read all your books, as you know, Jeff. We talked about this last time you were here. And so I'm kind of suspicious when this thing comes about. And I'm thinking, okay, what's he doing here? You know, but it was such a fun twist. And I really enjoyed that. I'll tell you who else I enjoy in your books. And I don't know if he'll ever have a bigger role, but that is Lincoln's caregiver.
Tom, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tom is a really interesting guy. Will you ever bring him more into a main story, do you think?
It's interesting, Pam. I have thought about that. He is a character, for your listeners again who may not be familiar, the caregiver to Lincoln Rhyme, who, being so disabled, of course, cannot physically take care of himself. To be blunt about it, bathroom duties and
sure,
feeding that have to take place, dressing, baths,
right,
and showers and things. And I don't really dwell on that much in the book, but that's the reality of it. And it is a very specific and disciplined set of skills that one has to have to do that.
Yes.
First of all, you have to be very strong, you have to be very physical, and you have to be able to put up with a lot of garbage, because the emotional strain of being so severely disabled can take its toll on the patients. And so Tom is somebody who knows when to say enough to Lincoln Rhyme, doesn't let him get away with it. And they kind of call themselves an old married couple. That have come to an accommodation, and yet, you know, can be a bit snipey at each other from time to time, but that doesn't mean they don't underlyingly love each other or have
right,
a, you know, very, very deep relationship. But I have thought about ways to bring him more into the story, and I think I will do that in a book or two. So it's a very good suggestion and something that I think will happen. Many, many people like him a lot. They call him Tom.
I want him. Yeah, I want a Tom. I want a Tom. I will tell you that right now. Because
I could use one too.
couldn't we all? I mean, we need a wife like Tom. Really, he's just a great character, and he does provide a little bit of a chuckle every so often, because
sure,
you can almost envision this big guy rolling his eyes when Lincoln is acting out, and he does, you know, and he's. He can be kind of snippy and snotty at times, and very demanding about his booze and all that. So I kind of like the relationship that they have established. So I'm glad to hear that you might be using him again. I want to go and talk a little bit about Delivery Man, because
mm-hmm,
this book is so interesting to me. This book is a mystery in a mystery in a mystery over and over again. It's so hard for me to wrap my head around it. I read it twice because The Delivery Man, to me, was almost like a piece of flash fiction, even though it is a short story. It's
mm-hmm,
just amazing. So let's talk a little bit about The Delivery Man. And
sure,
why you wrote this. This is not your first time writing a short, though, is it?
No, I write quite a few short stories. What's unusual about this is a lot of it has to do with the fact that Lincoln and Amelia are very, very popular among my
yes,
readers. And I'm, you know, just delighted about that. But what that means is that if I do any kind of value added for the book, now value added for a novel you may be familiar, might be an author writing a biography of the character.
Sure.
Be writing possibly a memo, excuse me, a memo or a short story as if the character were writing that, him or herself. And it's just kind of a giveaway to the readers, or, you know, you may charge just a dollar or two for it, but it's something to acknowledge their interest in the character and kind of say thank you for that. Well, when my publisher and I were, Grand Central Publishing, when we were talking about plans for the Steel Kiss, and I'd pretty much finished it, they said, well, I wonder what kind of value added we could do for this. And we came up with the idea of doing a short story that had Lincoln and Amelia in it. And it might be completely unrelated to the Steel Kiss, just something coincidentally that had those had the same characters in it. But I thought, well, how's this? There's a crime that's referred to very obliquely in the Steel Kiss. It's a murder, and it provides a clue that ultimately is somewhat helpful at the end of the book in tracking down this mm-hmm. horrific man I mentioned, the guy who hacks into the computer systems.
Yes.
Well, but the crime occurred, and that crime itself was never really followed up on. It provided some evidence, but that's really all there was to it. And I thought, what if we take that crime and go out on a, I guess you could say like a branch or a limb on a tree of the novel, and provide even more insight into that crime and more insight into the characters involved. And I said, well, I'll give it a shot. And I'll tell you a funny story. We decided this pretty late in the game. The Steel Kiss was already, it may have been on press at that point. And I didn't have a lot of time because it was going to come out in, I think, February, you'd said. I don't remember the exact.
Yeah, February 16, update. I think it came out, yeah.
Okay, so this was really like in January, early January, we were talking about this. And I said, okay, I'll do what I can do. And so I came up with a plot, I did my outline, and then I sat down and wrote it. I wrote the whole thing in about 2 days, 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
It's about 17,000 words, and I remember at one sitting, I wrote 9,000 words, the most I've ever done. And for your listeners, that would a page, a double spaced page of on your computer or typewriter would be about 250 to 300 words. So you can.
Right.
I'm very bad at math, so somebody could figure out how many pages that was. And
sure.
You know, I just banged the thing out. Then I edited it quite a bit, and I had the help of some very good editors to copy edit it and make sure it worked out. It was the writing was too awkward or embarrassing. Right,
right.
Exactly. And so so that it came out, and I think it really adds to the book. Now you can figure out the killer in Steel Kiss without reading The Delivery Man, but it in itself is a very interesting standalone story with some good twists in it on its own that ultimately come back. At the, I should put it this way. At the end of The Delivery Man, there are some plot points that appear to be left hanging, although the crime is solved, but the plot points that appear to be hanging. And what happens? You start reading The Steel Kiss, and bang, they come right back.
There it is.
And you can see how it all comes full circle. And I had great fun doing that. And it's something I'm going to think about for future books.
You know, it's interesting. I was speaking to your publicist, and I had said to him, you know, I bumped into Jeff at BoucherCon, and we decided that we would do a show again. And so he said, okay. And as soon as Kiss was ready to come, I got the galley. And I had been reading through a newsletter or something where you made a mention of The Delivery Man. It mm-hmm. wasn't yet out. As a matter of fact, he actually sent me the Mobi file. No, I have it in PDF, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we haven't even printed it yet. And I said, I don't care. I want it. So
mm-hmm.
I read Kiss first and read Delivery Man afterward. And I thought, damn, if I had only known, you know. But it's a
right.
great standalone story by itself. You don't have to read them one right after the other. But it does kind of tie some things up a little bit. If you,
oh, sure. Yeah, I was very
careful. Yeah, it gives you a push, I think, you know, and it
yeah.
makes you really want to read Kiss. It really does. It's a
well,
fabulous
and, you know,
book.
I find with books I'm really in love with, and I'll just take an example, Lord of the Rings, which I read many times in my youth. Tolkien would very cleverly branch out and write other books. After, he may have written them during the writing of The Lord of the Rings, which is a very long epic, of course. I'm sure it took him a number of years. But there were other books that related to little incidents and characters in the Lord of the Rings itself that then I found fascinating. And I think if I have to say I've not read all of the Harry Potter books, but I think J.K. Rowling did the same thing, that there are adjunct books. Certainly Tom Clancy has done that when it comes to spinning off characters. And, you know, so like he writes technical books about equipment and things like that. They may be nonfiction. But I just love creating a world and then branching out with other aspects of a book. And I think it worked well. And The Delivery Man is available at this point online only, but it will be available, will be printed in the Strand magazine. And if your listeners are not familiar with that, they should Google it and look it up.
Magazine.
It's one of the
Oh,
isn't it good, Andrew
it's
Gully?
It's the premier magazine. Yes, absolutely. Let's take a little diversion here, because I want to first of all just remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. My guest tonight is thriller master, international thriller master, Jeffrey Deaver. Jeff and I spoke last year and then saw each other in North Carolina at BoucherCon and decided we had such a good time we'd do it again. And, of course, now The Steel Kiss is out. It released today. It is available at booksellers today, both online and in brick-and-mortar stores. I hope you get it. It is an amazing book because it is a crime that you will understand when you read it. When we talk about technology, we're not talking about, you know, building dirty weapons or, you know, things like that. This is something that, this is a weapon in your own home that you don't know could potentially be a weapon. It's a fabulous book. And I have to tell you, Jeff, I was not anticipating the end of this book at all in any way,
well,
shape, or
thank
form.
You.
Yeah, that
well,
it stunned me.
As we've talked before, Pam, yes. I am not an author. I wish I were, but I'm not an author who can simply sit down and write a book. I don't start with a blank page one and then see where it's going to go. And frankly, I think there are too many books that are written that way. What I do is spend about 8 months doing an outline for a novel. That's a full-time job. Well, I say full-time.
Sure
I do the research
is.
At the same time. And during the course of that 8 months and looking at a huge corkboard in my office, and if this were a video podcast, I could, if there is such a thing, but a video cast, I guess we could
we're
say,
getting
oh, there.
There
is. Oh. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
We're getting there.
I could turn around and point my webcam. You're right. I'd have to take the tape off it first, but
right.
I'd do that
right.
And then
exactly.
And then show you the corkboard. But that's where the twists come from in that outlining process. So that by the end of the 8 months, 7 or 8 months, I have the plot 95% figured out, and only by doing that can I integrate the plots into the book, because it otherwise is so hard to hammer them in after you've created most of the book. You have to start at the very beginning and make them a legitimate part of the story.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that when I think back of all the books of yours that I've read, there are, I mean, in most thrillers, I think there are a lot of storylines going together, and sometimes the threads get tied up at the end, sometimes they don't, but yours are very, you have a very intricately detailed sub-story going on that if you don't pay attention, I think you miss a lot of the joy in reading such a well-written thriller. I think it's critical that at least I notice it in your books.
Sure.
I will think, sure enough, this is it. This is it. I've got it now. I've got it figured out. And you totally blow me out of the water every time. And I'm not I'm a fairly savvy reader. I read 400 books a year. I
oh my gosh.
Love thrillers. Yeah. So, well, you know, no TV again. So,
right,
exactly.
That helps.
And I want, I want to know, I want to read. I love reading. It's tons of fun. I have no life, but, that's not true. I
have
You've
a
good life.
You've got a life in literature, we could say, Pam.
I do. But I mean, I socialize too. But the fact is that I find very few authors do that as masterfully as you do, Jeff. It makes the reading so much more enjoyable.
You know, Pam, something interesting. I sell a lot of books, and I have many, many fans around the world, but I don't sell in the numbers that, and I won't mention names, but other authors do that are just off the charts, stellar celebrities, you might say. And I think one of the reasons for that is that my books are, frankly, a bit more challenging, but because of all the twists and the turns and the plot reversals. But I can't write any other book. I cannot do it. When I was approached by the Ian Fleming Estate a few years ago to write Carte Blanche, the Bond book, which I mentioned earlier, the decision that I faced was this. I could write a James Bond book in the style of Ian Fleming. Now, Ian Fleming wrote a very linear story with no twists and turns whatsoever. We knew the good guy up front. We knew the bad guy up front. And we were just waiting for the showdown, sort of your classic Western from the 1950s. I don't write that, though. I can't do that. And I told them right up front, I'm very honored that you'd ask, but I have to write a Deaver book, which involves layers of subplots, each with its own twist and turn, each of which is kind of integrated into the main story. And what you see isn't what's really happening until the very end when it's all revealed. And then there's another revelation and ideally another one after that. And they said, no, they knew my writing. They were fine with that. And you know, the book did quite well, but I cannot write a less complicated book because I feel it's more emotionally engaging. And that if you play into the game and you sit down and you follow my book, you are going to have a roller coaster of a ride that other novels, sometimes you just kind of sit back and relax. And I call it the bedside table test. And I have, I read not as much as you, but I try to read as many books as I can. And at night, I may put on I listen to a lot of books on audio downloads, but I may put on a book or I may read a book. And there are some that I read in the middle of the night, and I read, two, three chapters, close it, put it down, and I think I'll get to it tomorrow. My goal for my books, I hope this is true, is that you can't do that. You pick up a Deaver book and start to read it. You're going to finish it that night.
I have never put down one of your books. And, you know, you say that you want people to be emotionally invested in it. I have to tell you, Jeff, that I like to be intellectually invested in it. This is intelligent thriller crime fiction. This is you can't read cozies and enjoy cozies and then read a Deaver book. It just doesn't work. I think that you have to, your brain has to be engaged along with the discovery. Now, I don't have all the knowledge that Lincoln Rhimes has, but I'm certainly savvy about reading a Deaver book, and I know I'm going to learn something really interesting in there. It's a challenge to read your books. They're not ever the same. I know that you are going to challenge me to pay attention to everything, and that's really special.
And when I sit down to write a novel, I'm utterly mortified that I will disappoint the readers. Every book, this is my, Steel Kiss is probably my 37th, I haven't counted lately, but I think my 37th novel.
Yeah.
And I am horrified, and I have my chops down pretty well. I know how to do it, but I'm still mortified that my inspiration will fail me this one time. That I will distracted in my writing and come up with a plot that doesn't make any sense. I will be lazy about it. I tend not to be, but I'm always mortified that I will give the readers something that's not worthy of them. And part of that is to come up with those, those intellectual puzzles that do engage them. And it can be a bit of a a chore at first. I get a bit frantic. I do a lot of pacing. I stare at my corkboard and sort of like Lincoln Rhyme in fury. I say, that's not going to work. What on earth am I thinking of? That's nonsense. People
yeah.
will laugh me off the printed page.
No, I think you at this point you've kind of got it down. You've kind of got it down a little bit. So I want to talk to you a little bit more about Lincoln Rhyme. Are we still peeling away his layers, Jeff? Are we going to find out more about him? Because as I mentioned earlier, when he came to an emotional decision about his life.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to learn more about Lincoln?
Sure. That's part of the fun of writing a series. You don't get everything about a character, nor should you, in the first episode of whether it's a TV show or a series of movies or a book. About, this goes back maybe 4 Lincoln Rhyme books, I created his cousin, Arthur, and
yes.
looked at his family. Lincoln's and Arthur's family going back to the Midwest
right.
where they grew up. And that was not digressive. It actually played an important plot point in the book. But I needed to expand him. I needed to take Lincoln out of his immediate, very circumscribed world and open him up a little bit. And we haven't really seen much more of that in the 2 or 3 books since then. In The Steel Kiss, we expand Amelia quite a bit because
yes.
now we see her connection with her mother, who is
yes.
Quite ill, and then with Nick, the former boyfriend who has come back and is turning to her for professional help, but he also is kind of testing the waters and understandably knows she's with Lincoln, but is wondering, is she with him out of sympathy? Is she with him simply because she's a nice person, or is she with him because they truly have a deep personal relationship that is romantic in nature as well as professional? And you know, Nick isn't quite sure because he hasn't been in that situation. And that subplot moves along quite well, and we learn more about Amelia. But you're absolutely right that within the next few books, we're going to see a little bit more of. A little bit more of Lincoln. You know, he was married some years ago, and he had another partner. Now, this is before he was disabled, had a woman he was involved in who, and this has been explained in a book. It's not in one of the earlier books, it's not a surprise. But she was killed in the line of duty.
Right.
And I have actually thought about writing a book in which we jump back and forth in time. Now, I couldn't really write a prequel to The Bone Collector because Lincoln and Amelia did not know each other at that time.
Right.
And my fans love both of the characters. Now, I could
yes.
do parallel chapters, which is something I've thought about doing, but we would never see them together, and the interplay is quite important to readers, I think. So we will learn more about them possibly by going into the past and with some surprising consequences there.
Interesting. Would you care to take a call, Jeff? I have someone
I'd
calling
love
to.
To
speak to.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'd love to.
Okay, let's see. Area code 928, you're live on the air. Who's
Hello, Pam. This is Morgan Jameson calling.
Hi, Morgan. How are you?
Hey, Morgan.
Say hello.
How are you doing?
Say hi to Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. Hey, I saw that you were going to be on again, and I really enjoyed the last one, your last show with Pam. So I had to call in, and I have to tell you.
Didn't you call in last time? I thought so.
I did, yeah. And we spoke briefly. And when I heard the premise to Steel Kiss, I had to call in because as an electrician for 20 years and a former robotics major, this kind of thing just scares the hell out of me.
I'm so glad I continue to give you sleepless nights, Morgan. Thank you so
you
much.
You do. You do. And what you said, you know, as a writer myself, it really hits me when you say, I'm terrified that I'm going to write a bad book, that I'm going to write a book my readers want to put down. I think that's a wonderful goal. Every book should be something they don't want to put down.
And on that topic, I approach every book as if it were my first and as if it were my last. And by that I mean I have to put all the energy into it that I put into my writing my first book. That means concentrating 100%, doing all the diligent work I need to do. And I write it as if it were my last, meaning I'd want to be remembered for that book. I tell that to my students, and they seem to appreciate that. And so if I had to give any advice, that's something to keep in mind.
And it shows in your use of red herrings and the layers of, and the comp, you know, despite it being, you don't write simple books. The whole thing about James Bond I loved, because your books are complicated, but they're smooth, to the point, succinct, and they carry the reader along.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I try to work on that very hard. Are you working in the mystery genre?
I write literary and thrillers. I just finished my third book, which is another World War II thriller. I should have it off to my agent here at the end of the week.
Well, good luck to you, Morgan. I'll make sure to stay in touch through my website or my Twitter handle. It's at Jeffrey Deaver, and maybe I'll come to one of your signings someday.
Well, that'd be
that?
Terrific. Listen, I have
Morgan,
a quick question.
Before you ask.
Sure.
Have you had a chance to read Still Kiss yet?
No.
Have you had a chance?
I'm going to read The Delivery Man first.
Okay.
I
will make sure that you get both books. And so you know my on my profile page, send me a PM with your address, and I'll get in touch with Andy, and he'll send out a couple books to you. Okay.
And I was going
to
ask you a favor, Pam. When I get the ARCs for this new book, it's really a woman's book. I mean, it's a man and a woman's book, but women. It's got three very strong women characters.
Great, I love that.
I think you're really gonna like it. So
send it
I was
on.
Wondering,
you know where
if
I
get an ARC to you when it's ready, would you read it for me?
You know I will. You know I will.
Okay.
So ask Jeff your question. You have the expert on the line. You can call me anytime.
Well,
go ahead and ask.
This is a quick question.
Sure.
As a writer, I have a book that I started some time ago. It's half done. I love the premise. It's great. I'm in love with the book. But I got into it, and it involves taking down the grid. Now, you know, a lot has been written on taking down the grid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I get into specifics. And basically, I've outlined a way that any redneck with $1,500 and a four-wheeler could take down the grid for months. The problem is I have a moral dilemma. I stopped writing the book because the idea of showing someone how to do that, if it ever happened, people died in Phoenix because the lights went out for 3 months, I would feel horrible. And my question to you is, have you ever had something like that where you ask yourself that question and you ask other people and they say, no, it's fine? And you know, I've talked to some EOD guys and different people involved in anti-terrorism, and they're all like, look, a black swan event is going to happen sooner or later. We all know that.
Yeah.
It might help us game it. But what's the writer's responsibility there?
Sure. I think the writer only has a responsibility to basically create the best story he or she can,
right.
A. But B, you have to remember that there are a lot of, as they say in England, nutters, crazy people out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reality is that people who are reading your books and my books are not going to suddenly slap themselves on the head and say, you know what, I've been thinking about doing something bad, and now I know how to do it. I think among our readership, we don't really have too many folks like that.
I don't think our books are
on the ISIS reading list. But just to hedge my bet a little bit, I tend not to give away specific information, and you really don't have to. I mean, any one of us could make a bomb. It's easy to do. I've got stuff in my garage. You do too, under your sink, to easily
go on YouTube,
make a
right.
Go on YouTube. Yeah, Google it. You know,
this is even simpler, and it doesn't involve explosives per se.
But I will tell you right now, and Jeff is absolutely right. I just finished another big name author, you know, one of the bestsellers, who wrote a book about that very thing in probably the same area that you're talking about, and it didn't involve a bomb or anything like that. So, and it was a very small cluster of people who were concerned with privacy, and they said, we're going to take down this place that houses all this data. And So, when you get in touch with me, Morgan, I'll send you the name of that book. I don't think you have to worry. You know, it's not your responsibility to be the police author of the world. Tell your story the best way you can.
I just, you know, I don't know. It's just one of those things that it's the first time I've run into this. And I mean, I've got 165 pages, and I stopped and went, wait a minute.
Well, I'll tell you the thing that I'm most concerned about, and it's why I do not talk about, say, making explosive devices or handmade guns or something like that, is the kids. My leadership includes teenagers, and I think we can all agree that young folks are not necessarily in the position to make the wisest and most mature decisions. And so that's what keeps me from putting too much technical information in. And, you know, the reality is you really don't need to do that.
You don't need it, right?
The implication should really be about the fact that the grid goes down or whatever you do. Or the fact is you can just come up with something completely ridiculous.
It's a key scene in the book, so I don't know. I'm just torn.
I know, you're wedded to it too, right? You like the scene.
Send it to me, Morgan, and I'll read it, okay? Just send me the scene, and I'll let you know what I think. Anything to worry about. Okay.
I'll do that. It's very rough right now, but...
That's okay. I think I have your address, but if I don't, send me a PM, and let me get you Jeff's books, okay?
That's wonderful, and thanks for having me. And sorry I haven't been around, but I've been writing, so...
Okay, well,
you.
Good for you, Morgan, and keep at it.
More important than anything. Keep going, Morgan. Thanks
good
for calling.
Thank you, Pam, and thank you, Jeff, and I will definitely looking forward to Steel Kiss and the Delivery Man.
Okay. Well, you take care now.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
I have one more call.
Sure.
And this is from, I believe this is from Teresa. Hi, how are you? You're on the air live.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for taking my call, Mr. Deaver.
Hello, Teresa.
I just want to say hi. I finished The Steel Kiss today, and actually it was my first book that I read by you. Uh-huh. And now you have a new fan. I was totally blown away.
Well, thank you so much. That means so much to me. I was just talking to an interviewer the other day, and he or she asked me, does it ever get old? You've written so many books, short stories now. And no, publication day, which is today, is very, very much of a thrill. And to hear someone like you say that you enjoyed the book and will be a fan now, I just got a chill down my spine. And that's after almost 40 years of doing this. So thank you.
Now I want to go back and read all your other books now.
You got a lot of
books
to read.
I mean, I was really, really, I have never seen someone who could take so few words and describe so much in with so few words. It was just, it's amazing.
Well, thank you. And isn't that a fun thing about books, Teresa, that you kind of, it's like stumbling on a found jewel or something like that, and you see,
Yes. Well,
I didn't even know this existed. Now I really enjoy it. And guess what? There are a whole bunch of other jewels out there somewhere for me to enjoy. And you've got you don't have to buy all my books, but you've got about 35 to choose from. So thank you for your support, and I hope you enjoy the others.
And I want to say something about
what I will.
Teresa, I want to keep on the line for a second because I want to make a mention to Jeff. The last time we spoke, I don't know if you remember, we talked about writing with an economy of words. I will never forget that expression. I talk about that all the time. When I speak with other authors who are just starting out, I always say, I can only share with you what the master said, and that is use an economy of words. You don't have to paint the entire background for your reader. You have to give them some leeway to be smart enough to understand that someone is moving to a bathroom, they have to go to the bathroom, or that they're leaving their home, or however it is, you know. So you have to use an economy of words. So, Teresa, it's interesting that you said that, because this is part of the first conversation that Jeff and I had. It was thank you for saying that.
Less is more. That's very important. Less is more.
Well, that was the first thing that I noticed when I started the book. I mean, I could not believe how much description was there with mm-hmm. just so few words. And mm-hmm. and I was blown away. I love reading an intelligent book. And it definitely is.
Thank you so much. Okay. And, you know, what I try to do is create a world that people can visualize, they can feel, they can smell. For instance, in the opening scene at the department store, you could smell the food, you could smell the perfume. You know how you walk past Macy's and you can smell all the mixed up perfumes there? Little things like
sure.
that just create a very vivid image. All right, that's what I try to do in any event.
Thanks for calling, Teresa. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, Jeff, as always, I take advantage of you by taking too much of your time. And I want
to
thank you.
Never. Always a pleasure
so
to
much.
Talk. No, this is great.
I'm thrilled. And by the way, congratulations on the new pup. What is the black baby's name?
His name is Monty. He is a Briard. That's a French herding dog that was brought to this country by Thomas Jefferson, as a matter of fact. And Monty had his first Westminster show, where he won a big fancy purple ribbon. So he did a good job there.
And you were Monty's handler because he's just
I was, indeed.
And you're having fun. And your championship is named, the championship hound that you have is named?
Well, his official name is Hugs and Kisses. And but his we have a call name. So the official American Kennel Club name that's registered to him is Hugs and Kisses. But his call name is his nickname is XO, which was also named because of a book I wrote a couple of years ago. So he's just one Yukonuba. He's a big champion dog. Yukonuba is actually a bigger dog show than Westminster is.
Westminster.
We were very proud of him. Yeah.
Congratulations. And thank you so much for being with me tonight. Will you come back again? Do you promise?
Of course, Pam. Oh, you're one of my favorite converses.
Thank you. I love having you on, and I always learn something wonderful and new from you. And, of course, I just have to rave about your books. For all those, remember, the Steel Kiss releases today. It's available everywhere. The Delivery Man, which is the short, is available online. It's an ebook right now, soon to be made into a paper book. Jeffrey mm-hmm. Deaver, you're magnificent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pam. I really enjoy talking to an intelligent and charming host like yourself.
You're so kind. Thank you so much, and I'll see you again soon.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye now.
You too. Bye-bye. That's our show for tonight, folks. Tomorrow night, I'm speaking to three wonderful women writers about writing for women and what it's like to be writers in the world today as we continue our Women Writers Month in honor of Women's History Month. And happy International Women's Day to all of you. You are terrific warriors. Thank you for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everyone.